First Peter, I'm just going to look at verse 1. 1 Peter 1, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the strangers scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. And may God bless the reading of his word. Barbara Davis was an administrative assistant at Penn State University. During the Thanksgiving season of 2009, she prepared an email for her department in which she thanked God. Her supervisor didn't like that religious language and told her to remove it, which she did. A year and a half later, in May of 2011, a coworker stopped by her desk and began complaining about the motto on the dollar bill. He didn't like "In God We Trust." The conversation turned into a discussion about gay marriage. Barbara was expressing her disagreement with her coworker when her supervisor walked by. And her supervisor said this: "We just came from a diversity event, and look at what you're doing." Supervisor then informed Barbara that she would be losing her job, and her job was terminated. The official reason for her termination was insubordination and failing to meet standards of professional conduct. Barbara now works in the pizza parlor and cleans houses for a living. Was Barbara really being insubordinate? Or was Barbara really the target of some kind of religious persecution? Unfortunately, stories like this are becoming more and more common in the United States. What was once the land of the free is now the land of the not so free. I've told you before that I believe Christians are being singled out and marginalized, and I really believe in my lifetime, stories like I just told are going to become so common, everybody in this church will be touched by it some way or another. Maybe you'll be the one who's the target of that, or somebody that you know will be the target of that. So how do Christians respond when something like that happens to us? Well, it's always good to answer questions like that before the fact so that you're prepared. There's an old saying that says to be forewarned is to be forearmed. I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, and I want us to be forearmed. So with that in mind, I'm beginning a new study this morning. I don't know of any book in the Bible that does a better job of addressing that question. How do Christians respond when they suffer for their faith than the little letter that First Peter wrote? It was really written for times like these. The church to which Peter wrote was at the beginning stages of persecution. Peter not only could see what was happening, he had a pretty good idea of what was about to happen, and he wrote to the church so they would know how to respond. It's a small little letter. It's just 105 verses long. In this little letter, Peter mentions suffering 15 times. He uses 8 different Greek words to describe it. But it's not just a theoretical treatise written by somebody who didn't know what they were talking about. This is a document that's very practical, written by Peter, one of the original 12 disciples of Jesus Christ. Peter not only learned about suffering from the Master himself, but he had a long experience from which to draw. So Peter has a lot of credibility when he speaks about suffering. My day job is in the seminar business. What I do is train people to do business seminars. Our seminars are 1 and 2 day long, and so it's either a 6-hour seminar or a 12-hour seminar, and so that's what I train people to do. One of the things we train them to do is, in the first 5 minutes, you need to establish your credibility. For instance, if you're teaching a project management seminar, people need to know that you're not just theorizing about project management. They didn't pay $400 to sit and listen to somebody theorize about something they really know nothing about. They want to know that you've actually been a project manager, that you've done it successfully, and they want to hear from your experiences. That's what constitutes credibility. Well, over the next several months, we're going to learn how Christians should respond to suffering and persecution, and we're going to learn from a real expert, somebody who's been there and done that, and that somebody ain't me. That somebody is Peter, who has been there and done that, and who is uniquely qualified to teach us about suffering. And so that's the message this morning. I want to show you how Peter is uniquely qualified to address this topic that constitutes such a big part of this little book that he's written. There are a number of things that qualify him to address this. I'm going to single out three for the sake of the message this morning. The first reason I believe that Peter was qualified to teach us about suffering is because of his years with Jesus Christ. Peter was the member of a very exclusive club. How many Christians do you suppose there have been since Christ ascended into heaven? I mean, there are millions alive today, and you count over the past 2,000 years, probably hundreds of millions of men and women have professed faith in Jesus Christ, and 12 had the privilege of actually living with Jesus Christ and watching his ministry close up, and Peter was one of them. It all started with the story of John the Baptist. Remember, John the Baptist was the forerunner of Jesus. He had his own disciples, and one day Jesus passed by, and John the Baptist pointed to Jesus, and he said to his disciples, "Behold, the Lamb of God." And two of his disciples followed Jesus Christ. You know, as I was reading this yesterday and preparing for this sermon, it evoked a song in my mind. I have Helen to thank for this. Signature Sound sings a song called "Since Jesus Passed By," and it's been in my head ever since. If I could sing, I'd just sing it for you. You'd probably prefer I don't, so I won't. But the chorus is so simple, yet it's so profound. The chorus says, "Since Jesus passed by, since Jesus passed by. Oh, what a difference since Jesus passed by. I can't explain it. I cannot tell you why. But oh, what a difference since Jesus passed by." Have you had that experience? I mean, you look at your life and you see what Jesus Christ has done and you just stand back and say, "Wow, what a difference since Jesus passed by." That was the experience of these two men who had followed John. Jesus passed by, and they followed him. And the Gospel of John tells us one of the two which heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first finds his own brother Simon and says to him, "We found the Messiah," which is being interpreted the Christ, and he brought him to Jesus. Peter was brought to Jesus by his brother Andrew. And then Peter could sing, "Since Jesus passed by." Oh, what a difference since Jesus passed by, because his life was never the same again. At that point in Peter's life, he had been a fisherman, and it appears that he came and accepted Christ as his Messiah, but he continued to fish because Christ hadn't said, "Follow me," yet. He'd simply accepted Jesus as his Messiah. Then came another day when Jesus passed by again. This time Peter and Andrew were plying their trade. They were out fishing, and Jesus walked by, and he cried out to them from the shore. He said, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." Matthew tells us that straightway Peter and Andrew left their nets and followed him, and thus Peter began the great adventure of his life. Literally and physically followed Jesus Christ all over Palestine for 3 wonderful years. He became what many have considered to be the leader of the disciples. He certainly was their spokesperson, their spokesman. Anytime you see a listing of the apostles in your New Testament, the one who leads the list is Peter. That tells you something about his prominence among them. More than that, Peter became one of the inner circle. Now, I believe that Jesus had hundreds of people who followed him from time to time. I mean, he didn't just have 12 disciples. He chose them from the many who followed him. And I think at any given time, he could have spoken the word and had hundreds of people around him. And from that larger group of disciples, he chose 12 that they should be with him. And Peter was one of those 12. But then over time, there emerged within the 12 an inner circle. The inner circle comprised 3 disciples. There was Peter, James, and John. I don't know how this came about, if it was by intent or it just kind of evolved or what constituted this. All I know is that Peter, James, and John were in a special inner circle, and they were privy to things that the other disciples were not privy to. For instance, when Jesus raised the daughter of Jairus from the dead, Peter and James and John alone from the other disciples were in his presence as he did so. When Jesus was on the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter, James, and John were the only disciples with them. They were the ones who saw Jesus transfigured before them. When Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane praying to his Father, "Let this cup pass from me, It was Peter, James, and John who were with him in the Garden of Gethsemane. They were in a very, very exclusive group. See, what I'm saying this morning is that Peter was uniquely qualified to talk to us about suffering because he had a unique relationship with Jesus Christ. On one occasion, Jesus had his disciples gathered around him, and he asked a simple question. He said, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" And some of his disciples said, "Well, some say you're Elias, some say you're Jeremiah, some say you're one of the prophets." And Jesus looked at them and said, "Well, who do you say that I am?" And you remember Peter's response? "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Boy, if there was ever a proclamation or a statement of faith, that is it, isn't it? And Jesus said, "Blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonas, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father which is in heaven." That's the man we're talking about with Peter. Peter was qualified to teach us about suffering because he spent 3 years with the Master learning about suffering from Jesus Christ himself. He was firsthand. He was there when Jesus said that, "Don't count it a strange thing when men turn against you." He heard Jesus' words about coming suffering. He saw Jesus preach the gospel. He saw Jesus work those miracles. He saw Jesus as he went about doing good. Peter was uniquely qualified to teach us about suffering. The second reason I think Peter was uniquely qualified was because of his early failure. Anybody who knows the story of Peter knows the story of his failure. It was that last night of Jesus on earth. He had just enjoyed his last supper with his disciples. And then he turned to them and he said, "All of you shall be offended because of me this night. For it is written, I will smite the shepherd and the sheep shall be scattered." But Peter said to him, "Although all shall be offended, yet will not I." And Jesus said to him, "Verily I say unto thee, this day, even this night, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice." Peter spake the more vehemently, "If I should die with thee, I will not deny thee in any wise. Lord, there no way I'm going to do this." Famous last words, right? "Even if I should die with thee, I will not deny thee in any wise." And we all know the subsequent story. Jesus took his disciples to the Garden of Gethsemane, and he went about a stone's throw away from Peter, James, and John and prayed, "Father, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, thy will be done." And the picture the Gospels paint of Christ in the garden is agonizing, writhing. I think he was rolling on the ground. I think he was just in misery because he was anticipating the sins of the world on his shoulder. He who was of purer eyes than to behold iniquity soon would become sin for you and I. Peter was in the garden. He saw all of that. And then Judas came with that band of soldiers from the temple guard, and he betrayed Jesus, and they dragged him off to the house of the high priest in the middle of the night. It was an illegal trial in every way. But Peter followed him. I don't know what Peter thought he was going to accomplish, but hadn't he told the Lord, "I will not deny you, Lord. I will stand with you to the end." And I think his intentions were good. And he followed Jesus, and of course he wasn't allowed in the house where the trial was taking place, but he was outside in the courtyard. Matthew tells us that a damsel came to him. A damsel is a young girl. She said, "Thou also wast with Jesus of Galilee." Why didn't Peter look down at that little lady and say, "You know, sweetheart, you're right, and I'm really concerned. I don't know what they're going to do to him." What a different story it would be had he done that. But you know what he did. He denied before them all. He said, "I don't know what you're talking about." When he was gone out to the porch, another little girl, maid, saw him and said to him, them that were there, "This fellow was also with Jesus of Nazareth." And again, he denied with an oath. See, this is Jesus who was, or Peter who was with Jesus when he preached that Sermon on the Mount. Remember what Jesus said about swearing? thou shalt not swear, neither by the heaven, for it's God's throne, neither by the earth, for it's his footstool, neither shalt thou swear by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king, neither shalt thou swear by thy head, thou canst not make one hair white or black, but let your yea be yea and your nay nay. Whatever is more than these cometh of the evil one. Yet here he is within sight of Jesus Christ. I swear by the temple, I don't know this man. We don't know what he swore by, we just know that he swore. After a while came to him they that stood by and said to Peter, surely you also are one of them. Your speech betrays you. Then he began to curse and to swear, say, I don't know the man. And immediately the cock crew. Luke's account is really poignant at this point in the story. Luke says at this point, Jesus turned and looked at Peter. Jesus is inside the house. Apparently there's an opening. Peter's outside in the courtyard. He's just denied Christ. The cock has crowed. The Lord turned and looked upon Peter. Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. Peter went out and wept bitterly. This failure marked his life from then on. 2,000 years have passed, and yet today, anybody who knows the story of Peter knows the story of his failure. Why did he deny Christ on that occasion? Fear. That's it. Fear. He saw what they were doing to his master. And he knew the Jews were in no mood to treat him any better. So if he sided with Christ, he put himself in a precarious position. It was just easier to keep his mouth shut or to deny that he knew Christ. And then he could avoid any suffering, couldn't he? By the way, that's one way to deal with suffering. Just deny that you know Christ. Nobody's going to persecute you if you don't know him. That's one easy way out, isn't it? I don't recommend that as a way out, but that's one way to avoid suffering. Here's a question. He denied Christ for fear of suffering. Did he succeed? No, because Luke tells us he went out and wept bitterly. That word bitterly could be translated violently. He wept violently. I don't know that he saw any more of Christ after that. I don't think Peter went and watched Christ on the cross. I think he was too ashamed. I think that night and the days that followed, he was just racked with humiliation, pain for what he had done. He was ashamed. So how does that qualify him to teach us about suffering? Well, it qualifies him because it tells us, like us, he was human. See, there's something about human failure that makes a person someone we can relate to. I can relate to Peter, can't you? Oh, I've never been in a spot where I've been threatened with real persecution, but I have been in a spot where I failed to take the stand for Christ I should have taken. Or where there was some sin I was struggling with and I was facing a temptation and I determined by God's grace I'm not going to yield to this. And then suddenly I turn around and I've stumbled and fallen and I've done this thing that I said I wouldn't do. I've felt that same shame, haven't you? See, the thing about Peter is not that he was a perfect man whose example is one we can never attain to. Think about Peter was, he was just like you and me. I can learn from that kind of person. If there was some pretense here about how much better he is than everybody else and be like me, well, maybe I'd be put off by that. But here's a man who knew what it was to fail. I doubt there's a person in this room who has never failed. Let God down. Let yourself down. Like Peter, you've discovered that the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Can you relate to that? I find comfort in learning from someone who has failed. Any of you know the name Joseph Stoll? Does that name ring a bell to anybody? Joseph Stoll had been the president of Moody Bible Institute. He came after I had graduated, so I didn't get to sit under him like I might have enjoyed. But he's a godly Christian example. He'd been a pastor for years before he went to Moody. He's no longer there. He's back in the pastorate. But he's the kind of guy that you hear on the radio and you see in these big Christian conferences. And you just kind of, it's the kind of guy you put on a pedestal and you think, wow, he's really attained. There's a man that I would like to be like, but he's way up there. No way I can be like that. Heard Joseph Stoll speak one time. He told a story that really impressed me. He had graduated from Bible college and he was in his first church. And this church expected the pastor to order the material for Vacation Bible School. And so that was one of his responsibilities. Well, there was a meeting coming up and they would meet with the committee for Vacation Bible School. And he'd put it off and forgotten to order the material for Vacation Bible School. So here we are in this meeting. And somebody looked at him and point blank said, Pastor Stoll, did you order the Vacation Bible School material? Well, if he admitted that he hadn't, now what are they going to think of their young pastor? Can't even count on him to do a simple thing like order material for Vacation Bible School. If he said he had and he really hadn't, well, yeah, that would be a lie, but tomorrow morning he could order it. Nobody would know any better. So he looked the man in the eye and said, yes, that order has been placed. What do you think of your pastor who lies to the Vacation Bible School committee? Like Peter, his conscience smote him. I don't know that he went out and wept bitterly, but I know he told the story of really struggling with what he had done. And then he had to call the board together again and confess that he had lied to them and ask their forgiveness, and he learned a lesson he never forgot. What that story did for me was it humanized Joseph Stoll. I've had those failures. I'm not perfect. I'm not on this pedestal where I'm above everybody else. I can relate to that. And in relating to that, I can learn from this man. I can learn from Peter. Peter's not much better than me. He was a human being. His failure encourages me because his failure was not final. He learned a lesson and he moved on. Peter is uniquely qualified to teach us about suffering because he spent years with Jesus Christ, because he knew what it was to fail. And the third reason I think he's uniquely qualified is because of his later triumph. Yes, Peter blew it. But then by the grace of God, he was restored. Here's a trivia question for you. Who was the first human being Jesus appeared to after he rose from the dead? I'm sorry? Say it again.
The women.
The women. So good. I was thinking I might entrap you, but I didn't. See, you're too smart for that. Mary Magdalene, remember on that Sunday morning, she went to the grave early in the morning. The stone was rolled away. And two angels appeared to her. She didn't know they were angels. And she inquired of them about the body of their Lord. Then she turned and looked, and there was a man standing there. She didn't recognize him. She thought that he was a gardener. And she said, sir, if you've taken my Lord's body, tell me where it is. And then Jesus spoke. He said, Mary. And instantaneously, she recognized him. It's a wonderful story in itself. Who's the second person Jesus appeared to after his resurrection? That would be Peter. Let me tell you how we know that. You remember in Luke 24, there's a story of the disciples on the Emmaus Road. One of them is named. It was Cleopas. The other, we don't know who it was. But they're walking toward Emmaus, and Jesus comes alongside of them. They didn't know who he was, and they can't believe that He doesn't know about all the things that had happened in Jerusalem during these days. And then Jesus took his Old Testament and began to explain to them what the prophets had said about the Messiah and how he must suffer and die and be raised again. And their hearts were warmed. They had no clue who they were talking to, but they were finding encouragement in this man. They got to where they were going and convinced Jesus to come into the house and eat dinner with them. And Jesus prayed and blessed the food, and suddenly their eyes were opened and they recognized who he was, and then he was gone. That to me is one of the most bizarre stories in the Bible. He's just gone. They were so excited. They dropped what they were doing. They ran back to Jerusalem. They found the disciples to tell them that Jesus is now alive. And the disciples said, "Oh, we know. Peter has seen him." Peter? The last time Peter had seen Jesus Christ, Peter was standing in the courtyard of the high priest's house, denying on an oath that he knew Jesus, cursing and swearing to convince those around him that he really didn't know him. And the last time Peter saw Jesus, Jesus looked at him. And that look reminded him of what he had promised. And Peter went out and wept violently. I wish we had a record of this meeting with Jesus and Peter. I'd love to know what happened, what was said. Peter fall down at his feet and weep. I don't know. What I know is that Jesus in his compassion and his grace made a point to see that Peter was the first one who would see him. Isn't that grace? Isn't that kindness? Isn't that like God? Christ restored him. And from then on, Peter did better. You follow his life now, and he's not perfect. He still has his foibles, and we could go through and we could cite what they are. But by and large, this man now stood firm. I mean, let's go to the book of Acts. I'm going to ask you to turn there. Let's just walk through. Acts chapter 3, Peter and John are going to the temple to pray. They go into this gate called Beautiful. There's a man laid at the gate who's lame. He's never walked a day in his life. He's 40 years old or a little older than that. And he looks up and he begs for alms. And Peter says, "Silver and gold have I none. What I have I'll give unto you. In the name of Jesus of Nazareth, rise up and walk." And the man got up and went running and leaping and praising God. The Jews didn't like what Peter and John had done. They called them on the carpet for it and warned them to stop preaching about Jesus Christ. And what did Peter do? Did he fold? Did he say, "Oh, well, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to offend you fellas. We'll make sure that doesn't happen anymore." Oh, this time he stood with his back straight and looked them in the eye. He says, "Whether it be right in the sight of God to hearken to you more than to God, judge you. For we cannot but speak of the things which we have seen and heard." That's a different man. And you know, it's really only been about 2 months since he stood in that high priest's courtyard and denied Jesus. He found some spine somewhere, didn't he? He got a backbone somewhere, didn't he? Where did that come from? Well, Jesus appeared to him that day and restored him. That's where it came from. Acts chapter 5, he was thrown in prison with the other apostles because they refused to stop preaching about Christ. In the middle of the night, an angel released them. And what did they do? Did they go hide? No, they went back out in the streets and picked up where they had left off, started preaching the same message. The religious leaders rounded them up and had them beaten. Luke tells us they departed from that beating, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name. And daily in the temple and every house they ceased not to teach and preach Jesus Christ. This is a different man. In Acts chapter 5, Herod arrested James, one of the disciples, and had him put to death. That made the Jews really happy. So Herod decided, "I'll do this again." He arrested Peter. Peter was his next target. Peter knew what that meant. Peter would die soon. That night, an angel comes to his prison cell, and he finds Peter sound asleep. I love the way the King James translates this. It says, the angel smote him on the side. He had to smack him to wake him up. Peter had learned a few things about suffering, hadn't he? Now he's just taking it as it comes and catching whatever sleep he can whenever he can. Man after my own heart. He's come a long way since that night in the priest's courtyard. He knew what it was to suffer. We don't know with certainty how Peter died. There's an ancient tradition that's very fascinating. Ancient tradition says he got caught up in the persecution of Nero, and he was sentenced to die by crucifixion like Jesus had died. Peter did not feel worthy to die like his master had died, and so he asked if they might modify the arrangement and crucify him upside down. I don't know that's what happened. I just know there's an ancient tradition. But we're certain he died a martyr's death. Peter knew what it was to blow it. He knew what it was to be restored. And then he modeled for us what it's like to suffer unjustly and to suffer graciously. This man is uniquely qualified to teach us about suffering, because he lived 3 years with Jesus Christ. Because he wasn't perfect, he knew what it was to fail. But because he also knew what it was to walk through suffering with his head held high and honoring Jesus Christ. This man can teach us some things about what happens to us when we're treated unjustly because of our faith. And that's why I'm excited about studying this little book. I think it's just what the church needs in this time to prepare us for what I'm afraid is coming. But even in this brief introduction, there's a message, isn't there? And the message is that if you've failed, failure is not final. Jesus Christ can restore you just as he restored Peter. Jesus Christ can do great things with you just as he did with Peter. Don't let those failures stop you from coming back and starting again. You say, but Pastor, you don't know how many times I've failed. And what difference does that make? Wasn't it our Lord who said that if your brother sins against you, forgive him 7 times 70? That's 490 times. You think Christ is tracking that on the 491st time he's going to stop restoring you? All he's saying is there's no end to this. You always forgive, and he will forgive you. You just need to come to him and ask him to, and he'll put you back on track. Let's pray together, shall we? Father, I thank you for your grace as it's demonstrated in the life of Peter. I thank you that you've given us this man as an example. This man who's uniquely qualified because he knew Jesus so well. This man who isn't something we can't reach to because he was human just like us. But then a man that you took and used in a mighty way. May we in days to come learn things that would make us more like Jesus Christ. And Father, I pray for some here this morning who have struggled. They have failed. They look at their failure and they think, how could God love me? It's all over. Would you reach out to them today like you reached out to Peter? Let them know it's not all over, that you can take their life and use them still. Would you restore them to service for Jesus' sake and in his name? Amen.